Hello, welcome to this week's episode. I'm really sorry about the lateness. I was just talking to my patrons. They have a little bit of bonus material, bit of time between us, bit of time between us and the patrons, the ones who actually care about me. We just talk about disassociation. And I was just saying, I think I've had disassociative episodes. I've assumed that dissociation was where you actually, you float above your body and see yourself. Where you are, but it's not. It's like a severance with emotional connections, like feeling nothing about anything. What this is, the article's about the adverse effects of meditation, and the aim of meditation is to relinquish the egoic self, is to relinquish the material world and material possessions, including the material possession of your own bodily carapace. Is that it? Carapace? Is that what? Is that the hard bit? That carapace. If I'm correct on this. A bony or chitinous shield. Yes.
Carapace.
Yeah. Boom. Perfect. Got that. Nailed it. So, anyway. Let's get to it. Oh yeah, what I was saying is I don't want to cry. I think it's a bit, feels like I feel like a pussy when I cry, and I want to I always want to yuck it up to as a diversionary tactic, so rather than crying I'd rather just take the piss, make jokes. It's why I'm probably quite hard to be in a relationship with, because I'll mock someone if they're being overly serious. If I think they're being overly serious, or, you know, they're being overly earnest, I'll just laugh it up, which is very irritating. My dad does it now, and it drives me mad. That's obviously where I've got it from. Okay, so yeah, we're going to talk about, I don't really know. I was just having a look at the pile of books I've got here. Nothing piques my interest. I suppose we could... Yeah, go on then. Let's go. We might as well go into a bit of... I'll tell you this first. Something might lead on from this. Just remember the story. I think I'm going to tell it on stage. Well, tonight I'm doing an online gig. I'm going to tell it as part of new material. And it's about, it's all, I was talking about Narcotics Anonymous. And I haven't been to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting in ages. I should make the effort to go. What is it about Narcotics Anonymous that's helpful, people ask me? I say it just gives you... It's the kind of communitarian spirit of the thing. It just gives you a slight sense of just uplift, of just having shared a space with people. We're all talking about stuff that, I mean, some of it you'll discard, some of it you'll relate to. Like, it's just that sharing a room with people, really, isn't it? Why the reason why people join clubs, etc. Not for everyone. Quite a lot of people, I think they need to lower their expectations. I don't know what I think they expected to be this kind of magic bullet that will solve everything. But it's like a communal purgation, which you can find also in comedy clubs, can't you? And when buoyantly innocent zest, bonding in boyish gluttony, as Howard Jacobson referred to it, which is, it doesn't have to be boyish, does it? But yeah, I need to go again. I haven't been for a while. I think it teaches you tolerance. I'll tell you why it teaches you tolerance, actually. The last time I went to was probably, well, definitely before lockdown. So, yeah, over a year ago, Jesus. I mean, that's the thing about the addicts. It's all about instant gratification, like a radical commitment to the present, which is actually similar to the immediacy of certain types of dementia. Whatever I can do in this very moment to escape an emotional pain that's always lying in wait. Like, I just, as I started talking on this podcast, had this slow sinking feeling. Like, just, I was feeling quite good. And obviously, you start talking, you expend a bit more energy, and you start to come down a bit. And just that slight shift, not being able to keep my emotions in a fixed position, just that slight reduction, sends your addict brain into overdrive, thinking, I need to find something. I need to find something to claw back. I need to be back on top. I need to be over the top. I need to be up the top. I need to be up in heaven. I need to transcend. It's an emotional pain. It's always lying in wait. I know the guilt of bad behaviour will haunt me in the end. But for now, if I'd taken the meds, it'll be temporarily extinguished by the sort of drug-induced ascension. And if committing bad behaviour is what it takes to get there, then so be it. Whether it's, I don't know, stealing drugs, stealing money, whatever. And when I'm on the precipice, the forked road between using or not using, I always make up an excuse, a confabulation as to why, in the long run, I'm better off taking the drugs. I'll misremember the many times when drugs have fucked up my week and tell myself taking opiates actually enhances my productivity. Like, I used to think, oh, you know, take opiates, and the initial high from it was like opening me up to potentially missed illuminances. So like illuminances within the world that I may have missed if it wasn't for my heightened receptivity brought about by opiates and the aerating effect. Yeah. Just listening to me try and spell is not a way to reward you for your patience. This was obviously, it should have happened. I missed last week's one, and many apologies for that. I just felt kind of depressed. I don't know, I just felt low, like what we're talking about now. And I'll misremember, yeah. And so, even though, like, say I stole drugs from an old man who needs them to manage chronic pain, which I haven't done, but if I was going to do that, I'd think I'm actually doing him a favor, because with the drugs in my system, I'll be better. I'll be a better, more attentive carer. So it's actually in his best interest. He's sacrificing some of the tablets for an improved overall standard of care. Like that he's basically paying me in tablets. He's paying me in tablets, and by paying me in tablets, it's improving my performance. And so he should be thankful that I'm stealing drugs off of him. That's the thought process, a deluded form of F-call speculative trading. Like, if I put this much in, there'll be this much loss, but then there'll be this much gain. I think it's something like that. Speculative trading. Like, yeah, I'll put this in. Cost benefit analysis type shit. That might be a good analogy. I don't know. There's only one universal addiction process, writes Gabor Mate in a seminal, The Realm of Hungry Ghosts. This is why people, when they go like, oh, what was your drug or what was your drug? It doesn't matter. It's one addiction process. What you decide to use as a balm, to anesthetize yourself is beside the point, really. They'd actually say using, weirdly enough, not needles, obviously, but say you smoke, if you smoked heroin, that has less long-term consequences then alcohol or cocaine or lots of other types of drugs, especially when it comes to your brain. You know, alcohol can really fuck that little head lump. It can really, turn that little head lump into a potato. The potatoing of the aged. His manifestations are multiple, from the gentler to the life-threatening, but in all addiction, it utilizes the same brain circuits of pain relief, reward, and motivation. It imposes the same psychological dynamics of shame and denial, the same behaviors of subterfuge and dishonesty. In all cases, it exacts the price of inner peace, harm to relationships, and diminished self-worth. In the case of substance addicts, whether enthralled to nicotine or alcohol or illicit drugs, it also jeopardizes physical health. If all addicts are afflicted with a sort of a psycho-spiritual emptiness that resides at the core, and obviously there's social conditions or circumstances that exacerbate this, that promote despair and potentially therefore addiction. Like, luckily, I'm very lucky to have a completely loving family, close-knit family, you know, friends I've had since I was born. Now I've got in better career opportunities that still aren't paying dividends financially just yet. I'm just getting a text. But yeah, that hopefully will. That definitely will. Contractually, it will, but just hasn't come yet. But then I worked in care work. That's a role that Gabrielle Winant in one of his books said is considered the most disposable of the health care workforce, despite the stress, the exhaustion, the utter thanklessness of the job. Is it any wonder that my drug use drastically accelerated in direct correlation with the staff shortages in the home? I think I've told you before about my friend. He is a guy I met on a bus, and he's about 68 years old. He's a guy I met on a bus. He's 68 years old, and he's sort of quite nomadic. Got like a salt and soil quality to him. He's like really kind of raw boned, if that's right. He's really raw, like he in very good shape for his age, you know, kind of thin, but viney. And I think he was an engineer, and he designs farming equipment. He walks everywhere, usually holding a bag full of charity shop purchases. And I'm sort of friends with him, and he's eccentric, but it's subtle. He isn't flamboyant. Like, he's bald, but has a few strands of hair on top of his head that, if he's not wearing a dusty baseball cap, he gels up these strands of hair like ant antennas. So I know if I'm about to bump my head, that's his reasoning. It's like they can, the ant antennas go up and they can alert him to the fact he's in imminent danger, and then he can, you know, move his head. Anyway, I occasionally knock on his door to see how he's doing or have a cup of tea with him. He's really boring, but in a way that's actually quite soothing and meditative when he talks to you. And he's always trying to imitate conversations with strangers, so he's obviously quite lonely. But do you reckon he'll lend me a tenner? Do you think he'll lend me a tenner? I could do with a tenner. I'd love a tenner.
Oh, I love a big fat tenner.
Ooh, I love a tenner.
I could do it with £10. £10. I love a tenner. Going up to London tomorrow. Going for a walk with someone. To be fun. Got a meeting with a TV production company in the morning. So I'm going to have to prepare for that later on. Won't tell you what it is about. Not until anything is actually happening. It's just a meeting. My worst period for drugs was sort of 2015-16, which happened to synchronize with the poisonous influence of Brexit and Trump. Both of which played a big role in my using. I listened to hours of political podcasts so I could hang all of my trauma onto the bloated, scowling, race-baiting Trump or the weird Albionic mythos and its connection to mystical gnosis that partially fueled the Brexit vote. Albionic, like the William Blakeian stuff. There was a religious zeal to the Brexit patriotism that is actually quite enticing in the right light. Only because I'm a sucker for that shit. I'm a sucker for it. And on work days, the morning sky would be pale and grey as I travelled to Chelmsford on the X30 bus, listening to Trumpcast and Political Gabfest on my iPhone. They were two that I liked. And downing Coke cans full of morphine calmed me, helped me to achieve a sense of connection with others. It gave me what I needed to get through a shift. Just 14 hours of like smelling the rough, raw groins and buttocks of elderly people caked in shit, which is terrible. These poor fucking people. And without something in the system, without the revelation of interconnectedness that opiates summon forth, it's too much to take. And that's the thing. You don't want anyone to be caked in shit. But when there's two of you overseeing 40 fucking people, how and there's over half of them require two carers in order to assist them with stuff. How does that work? And like we were just expected to get our heads down and work with like a phantom workforce. You know, it's the British model of care and labour, which when it comes to social care is similar to the US model in that it's private equity. And it's the kind of, it leads to questions about the neoliberal framework shared by the US and UK markets and the stupidity of trying to turn care work into another form of automation, which is not taking in the variegated chaos of being a person. It's annoying, isn't it? But I'll getting back onto what was I talking about? NA meetings. NA meetings. You have the similarities. So the similarities between NA meetings and dementia is quite tenuous. But it's not really. So you've got stuff like chemical kosh. Okay, for instance, let's talk about this now. So polypharmacy is common in the population, especially when it's comes to the elders. A good month, you know, a few good months of balancing drug abuse with the other areas of life, you eventually drift away into the murk of opiate dependence. And with the chemical kosh, so using sedatives or even major tranquilizers to subdue a resident or curb antisocial and disruptive behaviours. And I've witnessed it plenty of times within a care home, a drastic change in their demeanour after a visit from the GP, their agency eliminated as they're shuffled into a mental smog. Often the root cause of a resident's aggressive outburst or any other malfunction in their conduct is down to not being listened to or rudeness from a carer or being expected to comply with directives set by a person they neither recognise nor trust. But like, I believe there's an arbitrariness to social conventions anyway, so I don't even like to use the word antisocial, really. It's quite a prescriptive word, antisocial, and it can be used as a means of containing behaviour. At the same time, there is a social contract and we can't allow untrammeled libertinism. Like, even if temperamentally speaking, I find it to be an intriguing prospect. We'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But as Mark Corrigan in Peep Show says, when it's the drug episode, and he goes, while we're at it, there are systems for a reason in this world. Economic stability, interest rates, growth. It's not all a conspiracy to keep you in your little boxes, all right? It's only the miracle of consumer capitalism that means you're not lying in your own shit, dying at 43, rotten teeth, and a little pill with a chicken on it is not going to change that. Now, come on, fuck off. Very cathartic, satisfying bit of that episode. Underlying reasons should be examined before resorting to pharmacological solutions. The same with addicts. Get to the root of the discomfort, the disaffection, dissatisfaction, I think, dissatisfaction with yourself. But plying the elders with medication and forcing them into a lobotomized half-life is, to some managers, an expedient route to tranquility. And in a job where staff are permanently burdened with a high workload, cutting corners is enticing. And this is a real kind of confession. So in the past, to ensure, I didn't go along with it. In the past, to ensure that a manager's request for stronger medication will be approved, carers have been asked to embellish or fabricate behavioural charts to support their request. The more examples of bad behaviour documented in their personal file, the higher the chance of a doctor giving the green light to pharmacological intervention. They're writing short stories. They're lies. Right, short stories. Old novels are lies. It's all fiction is lies. It's right. They're writing fiction, aren't they? Just so that they can get this person fucking lobotomized, so they can get him in a crazy, dazed and stupefied state, barely able to speak. I struggle to see how facilitating a person's transition into stupefaction, I don't know if I'm not pronouncing it right, and doing it without their express consent is a form of care. I hate it. I hate to see people reduced to zombies all for the sake of convenience. I'd much rather deal with a pain in the arse than a ghost in perpetual surrender. It's... I mean, it's tough because, you know, especially with the kind of work my mum's doing with mental health at the moment, where, you know, they're adults with capacity. They're in like a halfway home and they have mental health problems. One, gone off, she's a 50-year-old woman. She's relapsed. She has gone off her fucking rocker. Going around prostituting herself, like, apparently. I believe sex work is work. Like, I believe it's work and should be regulated in the same way as work, and that sex workers should have you should be able to unionize and all that stuff. But she's not in her. She's not in a right mind to make that decision. It's just, you're just realizing like the kind of the major holes in the mental health system in this country is like this woman has gone off at the deep end. Like she's walking around, she's like trying to seduce, like we don't even know if it's true or not. She said she's trying to seduce a 14-year-old. She's got like pulled masks out of gutters, so she's walking around with all masks with all like dog shit and leaves on them. just cracked out of her eyeballs and a real kind of danger to herself. And you're ringing up the mental health support teams and they're like, why don't you try and get her to a meeting? Why don't you try and get her to an AA meeting? Are you joking? This woman is frantic, digging up like tobacco out of gutters, and it's just doing like, got like tardive dyskinesia, like involuntary facial spasms. It keeps going around doing like weird little things and building weird little, like what my nan did when she used to build weird little totem poles, and it's unnerving. It's unnerving. When my nan came up, rocked up to the door, boom, she's rubbed off her eyebrows, painted on big purple ones. And then she told me that she aborted a baby with that purple eyebrow pencil. She's going, and it had to go, and I stuck that up there, and I had to, I can show you. I was like, Nan, do not get your fucking fanny out. Just calm down, Nan. I had to get going, Nan, I'm your grandson, Nan. And, like, you know, because she had big McDonald's eyebrows, like purple eyebrows, like in the shape of the McDonald's logo. In a care home, I wish I had time to create an expansive record of the residents' daily lives. It's always, the records aren't, I mean, no one keeps good records, really. Maybe with the stuff that could be numbered, like medication and that, but when it comes to the daily observation records, because there's so many, it's all done manually. It just takes forever, so they just try and do it quick and easy. And, but I'd like to talk about, like, the, you know, the temporarily alliance, like the with the care I do now, it's one to one with a guy who I love to bits. He's a year older than me, but he has like the mental capacity of someone who's, you know, a lot considerably younger, maybe like two or three or something. And when I have to, like, I just basically have to. My role is to help facilitate a controlled rampage, basically, to just let him blow off some steam, go for a walk and that. Me and him boot, well, he's in a wheelchair, but like, I boot around a football and go a bit crazy and look like I would like sort of jump onto the drums and make a big, he likes big, like he likes calamity. He likes chaos. As long as it doesn't go too fast, then he'll go no more. And that means I got a bit too rowdy. And he likes to go up and like try and punch cars, but not in an aggressive way. It's like a boisterous kid or something. And then I put him to bed and I sit outside his door for the final sort of hour. And there I can write, and then I write down exactly what we've done for the last, you know, however many hours. And I make it very comprehensive. You know, what kind of bands we've had, like what the conversations he was having with other people, games we played. It's nice. Didn't ever have the chance to do that with the care home. I'd like to have written about like the temporary alliances, the little acts of vengeance. So the little acts of vengeance, the polyphonic squabbles between a table full of elders, each of them having separate conversations, running in tandem, though never combining. So sometimes you'll observe just two of them engaging in a conversation, only to discover they're each wrapped up in their own monologue and speaking to each other, but independent of one another. So it's like they're two conversations crossing swords. Conversational sword fight. It's called cross stream conversation, cross split screen. No, conversational sword fight. Crossing streams, like two crossings. A crossing stream. Conversational. No, that's all right. Even the sort of prurient comments made by indecorous old men. Comments that are either tolerated, rebuked, or artfully circumvented by care staff. It's all part of the normal workday for us. And afterwards, the carers reconvene in the CTM's office and argue whether the old boys, the residents who are tapping into an essential goat man lecherousness were always like that, or whether it's the dementia talking. I mean, I remember one gentleman, while lying in his bed with Songs of Praise on the television, asked me whether he could have a tug on my female willy. I mean, the main symptom of Alzheimer's is temporary memory difficulties, but like the frontal lobe dementia, which is a lot rarer, and the diagnosis my nan received, there can be like a warping effect on the personality. Amy Bard writes in Sex in the Brain how seizures, strokes, dementia, tumours and trauma can change your sex life. The behavioural changes are often first noticed in social situations when a person shows a lack of empathy or may become disinhibited or inappropriate. As the frontal lobe plays a critical role in human sexual behaviour, along with initiating and sustaining of behaviours, mediating social and emotional behaviours, and task setting and monitoring. And for those affected with this type of dementia, their interactions can become problematic due to the, you know, sexualized overtures. That's what I say to people when I say you have to take into account that sometimes people aren't socialized or aren't conditioned to realize when something is inappropriate. Like, for instance, say it's such a tricky one, because it's what I've noticed is like there's whenever men make sexualized comments to women under the guise of a joke, women must just be fucking exhausted with it. Must be exhausted that that's always their, you know, I meant like a man's go-to to, you know, in how to interact with a woman. And there can be an over-familiarity to it. And someone who wrote this the other day wrote, you please think about parasocial boundaries and how you talk to women you don't know online. Thanks in advance. The problem is, if you're putting a lot of your life online, people start to feel like they know you, that they know, like they know you on a personal level. And if they're a fan of your stuff, you've cultivated this kind of clubhouse mentality of like this kind of clubhouse inner circle conspiratorial kind of following, where people think like you know that this is part of the deal. Like, it's like friendly banter, it's battle, but like banter between friends. I wrote about it one sec, I'll see on here. I mean, that's good advice. You should be aware of the social boundaries and stuff. And I'm trying to find it, sorry. So yeah, I don't send lecherous DMs or any of that shit. You know, unless like, I mean, I've got that kind of sexual relationship with someone and it's solicited, obviously. But I've learned post Me Too is that women are rightfully conditioned to be wary of men, and you can't just assume you'll be seen as a benign sociable presence. You have to demonstrate you're an all right person by getting to know someone. But remember, no one owes you their time or their attention. If someone wants to shut down line of communication, that's their prerogative. Whatever gender they are, if I think someone's struggling, I'll chuck them a reply or a DM saying, I hope you're okay, etc. But I've realised that even that can be invasive. I don't know what the answer is. Because they're... what some people are doing are shaming the kind of... just like, if men's are made a sexual joke, I don't want to say it's harmless, because it can make... it can make people feel really uncomfortable. But you can maybe tell it's done with the best of intentions. It was done to sort of, you know, establish a little bit of a repartee between you and someone else that you're following in line. And then this person, she extracted his comment. I just think it's better not to shame an individual. It's better not to shame an individual. It's to talk about in general terms. Like, look, this has happened. This is not okay. Everyone's allowed to demarcate their own boundaries, and you're in the right to do that. But I don't think it's fair to like pick on one person, especially. If it's getting to you, it's a recurrent thing, isn't it? So if it's happening a lot, why just zone in on that one person? But I don't know what the answer is. Yeah, maybe swallowing pride. Don't take it as a personal slight if someone wants to shut down a conversation. And if it is a personal slight, reflect on why that might be the case. But like, do it in your own head. Don't burden the other person with your insecurity. They've already closed down the conversation. Number two, self-awareness. Absolutely vital. My good friend Martin Willis always said, there's something that every good comedian has in common that they share is that they have, you know, quite a robust capacity for self-reflection. And they have a lot of self-awareness. Number three is reading social cues. Well, also understanding that this can be hard for some people, autistic people, for instance. Number four, firebomb your bridges by dredging up years of accumulated receipts and posting them on Twitter to shame the person who has ostracized you. And then number five, join a far-right neo-Nazi group to alienate everyone you used to know and reclaim some control over your life. And number six, run for a local council position. I mean, that's just one method. That's just one way of dealing with this stuff. But it does. It's understanding from all sides, isn't it? It's understanding from all sides. Frontal lobe to me. Get your lobes out for the lads. About frontal lobe dementia. Get your lobes out for the lads. But why deny the uncomfortable truth of a person's lived experience, especially if we have insights into the underlying reasons for aberrant sociality? But the daily observation records are a diplomatic erasure of the ugly phases of a life, the ones that we write in the care home. It's a shame because we're missing so much. We've got these elders who have their own, you know, lives in the home, and they're traipsing along corridors, staggering across carpeted lounges like rusted figures in an automaton clock, like the Trumpton clocks, you know, and forever in search of female willies. Some people are abject because they are similarly expelled from the social body, writes Philip Skopansky in an essay entitled Addiction, and Humour, Craig Ferguson's Confessional Stand-Up. This category applies generally to people at the margins of society, including the homeless, mentally ill, and addicts. A good example, De Grissel. So it's a fact. Keep the gristle left on. When people become symbolically connected to objection, now they're cut asunder and struggle to be fully integrated into the social body. Through confession or dwelling on the ugly truth, refusal to deny the unpalatable part of ourselves, a kind of rebellion against the officialdom of social etiquette, making it familiar. Once it's familiar, it's on its way to being rehabilitated. And if it's not totally accepted, at least it deepens people's understanding. The understanding and acceptance is one of the tentpoles of holistic humanism. As Adam Gopnik writes in an article about Marcel Proust, called Peripheral Proust, if you want to find it online, in the pages of his book, he regularly dramatized the relationship between cruelty and tenderness. and the appetite for kindness and delicacy, along with humiliation and savagery, is a fundamental part of the dynamics within the care home. From the same article, he reported with what truth is hard to say, to have had a taste for, Proust he means, to have had a taste for sadistic sexual rituals. In one particularly grotesque account, bringing himself to climax by watching rats forced to fight with one another in his presence. I once got a boner from the sound of someone washing up. That's like about it from me for weird. So I love big, big, big oily tits as well. Big, like, oiled up tits. That's it for me. Right down the middle. No mucking about. Lovely, big, oily tits. Job done. It's all I need. It's all I need. And I said, like, Philip Roth is actually a lot more of a creep than I realised. I'm sticking with the Blake Bailey biography, despite, you know, what we now know about Blake Bailey and how there's going to be a, you know, permanent synchronicity. Then Philip Roth in death and Blake Bailey now are going to be eternally bound to each other. And it's going to kind of make Roth's behaviour seem even muckier, because, I mean, what Roth had a predatory quality, but Blake Bailey is accused of, you know, grooming children. Though there's a few bits in the about Roth and his, like, stepdaughter. He didn't do anything untoward, and she, like, vouched for that. But she said, you know, she was a young girl at 13 who was sexually coming into her own, you know, going through puberty, and she was flirtatious towards her stepdad, and he never reciprocated, but he did say to an ex-girlfriend that he was having sexual feelings about a 13-year-old. And she said that was obviously the girlfriend's, that was a red flag for me, and I scarpered. But you don't know, do you? Because you don't know if that was, they don't flesh out this ex-girlfriend. We don't know what her agenda is. I'm starting to sound like, there's just not enough context for us to make a definitive judgment on that within the book. And knowing what we now know about Blake Bailey, why he might have seized upon that to act as, you know, like a normalizing detail for his own deviancy. So yeah, Philip Roth is a creep in a lot of ways, more than I realise. But this sounds like the ideal life. So I'm a sucker for domesticity. I want to have dinner, have a drink, read, get in bed, fuck, and go to sleep. What else is there? Yeah. Definitely. I'm a sucker for domesticity, but I like to break off every now and again and go on a, you know, like a 4-day jaunt on my own to some faraway exotic land, like Luton. No, to like Finland, or I'm going to go Norway. I'll go Norway at the end of the year, I think. I gravitate towards care work because it's teeming with both compassion and conflict, with healthy personas, oscillating morality. It's ripe with humanity, isn't it? Plus, I'm more at ease sitting with Gilbert, reassuring him that it's a catheter balloon and he hasn't sucked up his bollock through his knob hole. More comfortable in these marginal spaces with unfairly marginalised people than I am situated in the mainstream. So I'm not ploughing the same furrow as that hedonistic party boys of stand-up comedy, which I sometimes get compared to. Not explicitly, but I think we've sometimes put in the same category. I got high-end salt friendship in a care home, for Christ's sake. We're like salt and soil bus blokes. Once hired a sex worker. Didn't even touch her. Just sat and watched a episode of The Good Place. Actually, two episodes of The Good Place to keep myself safe. So I just tried to kill myself. Well, I was supposed to talk about Narcotics Anonymous. God, we've really gone. So this whole episode has been mentioned once, and that's the title of it. I'll get to. I'll talk about this woman quickly. So she's a. I'm going to have to be really careful about how I've written a bit. She's. So as I was reading the book, this cleaner, she looks like a big overgrown baby. And she seems a little bit like. Seems like she's had like a kind of arrested development. Like she might have learning difficulties. And she was a cleaner at my care home. And she's dating a man who is a lot older than her, like old enough to be a granddad, no judgment. She was well of age and stuff. And she sort of skulked into the staff room. And this was the kind of interactions I would say. She was a sweet person, like a harmless malingerer, but she has a habit of appearing at the exact moment you settle into contentment and want to be left alone. And even though she has an equal right to occupy this space in the staff room, she uses it so much, especially on days like today when management isn't in. This is written as if it's on New Year's Eve. And nothing much is different. We didn't really celebrate New Year's Eve in the care home, which is always strange. We should all have passed a syringe driver around, all had a go on ones, not just the selfish, greedy terminal patients. All had a go on it and quietly died during Hootenanny. Perfect. Perfect little death. There's another problem. Her vulnerability and pathological shyness is made manifest with every awkward encroachment into your personal space, followed by panicked retraction and then a string of apologies. And people like this make my heart sore. They're so clearly ill at ease with themselves and how they relate to other human beings. And I want to offer reassurance, but it would never subdue the unrest within. Like, I've been there. I know. I get it. And because of this constant nervousness and social ineptitude, her very presence in the room becomes burdensome. You can't help but take on her emotional baggage. There are just some people like this. They're so kind of like, they're just so kind of like children, aren't they, that you can't help but feel sort of duty bound to, you know, to ease their awkwardness. And eventually this curdles into an unexpressed exasperation, sort of in bracket, we're breaking our backs caring for elders, can't the staff sort themselves out? So whenever she's around and jittery and eyeing me timidly as she pours a cup of coffee, I think, you're a proper imposition. How horrible is that? To think about another person that way is horrible. It's another one of those micro negotiations between an unsustainable permanent kindness, the surface acting, and a surge of splenetic feeling that rises up only to be nipped in the bud before reaching full expression. Is that Da Vinci Code? She asked with both a lisp and a stutter. Double whammy, pointing at my rehab diary. It's a green ring binder containing whole punch sheets of paper. She's asking if it's Da Vinci Code. Ah, no, it's just the thing I had to write while I was in hospital, I reply, suppressing the desire to say, of course it's not fucking Da Vinci Code. It's a ring binder. I also changed rehab to hospital to avoid the social stigma, an unfair retrograde view of drug treatment programs, but one that still holds some sway in conservative ethics. I went to hospital, well, not hospital, but it was my social anxiety. I'm really anxious all the time, she replies. I'm forced to weigh up my priorities in real time. Here's a person in pain looking to ignite the leaping sparks of friendship, sparks that jump between two people who have a shared experience, have both been in institutions. Do I indulge my selfless, chivalric side and surrender to a delicacy of feeling? Or do I opt for unrepentant self-interest? Sorry, I need a shit, I reply. Afterwards, I stand up, tuck the ring binder under my armpit and go to the ensuite attached to the staff room. That's how I got her out of the picture. I'll tell this other quick story, and then I'll be off. And this is what it's all been building to. It's not that good a story, actually. I'm building it up too much. So this is the NA part of the story. Okay, I'm just trying to find it. I'm trying to make sure there isn't any dead air, because dead air is bad for you. So actually, I'll talk about the two places. The two places, other than certain, virtue. So, Iris Murdoch wrote, "I would like to say that all great artists are tolerant in their art, but perhaps this cannot be argued. Was Dante tolerant? I think most great writers have a sort of calm, merciful vision because they see how different people are and why they are different. Why they are different. They are different. Tolerance is connected with being able to imagine the center of reality, which are remote, the center of reality, which are remote from oneself. There's a breath of tolerance and generosity and intelligent kindness which blows out of Homer and Shakespeare and the great novelist. The great artist sees the vast interesting collection of what is other than himself and does not hold the world in his own image. I think this particular kind of merciful objectivity is virtue. The artist, but also the carer. So tolerance, mercy, generosity, intelligent kindness. These are the attributes of a good carer. It's about accepting individuals as they come and leaning into the utter ordeal of people, knowing people, chatting to people, mourning people, managing people. Vast mycelial network of sprouting emotion, personal entanglements, and cumulative trauma. Catastrophes and frustrations, jealousy, envy, and vengefulness. Briefly terminating a friendship after an argument about how to spell the word compass, which resulted in a person throwing a BMX out of Blockbusters. Things like that. That example is purely theoretical. The two arenas where I've developed tolerance or cultivated that merciful vision are working in care and attending Narcotics Anonymous meetings. Like, I don't condone certain behaviours, and I still believe there should be an injunction on harmful words and actions or repercussions to such words, actions, but I'm conditioned to accept the unstable boundaries of the self. And in devoting a chunk of my adult life to patient-centered care and recognizing both the differences and similarities in other people's values, interests, and capabilities, I've stretched my moral responsibilities to include entire communities or the common self. Part of a good communitarian health-centric approach is holding your hands up and saying, so some people will point a gun at their loved ones. C'est la vie. Peoples be people, eh? But in NA, but you come across, it's clearing a path. So it's about clearing a path towards forgiveness and redemption with some heavy lifting from the transgressor, using grace to counter wicked impulses in you or someone else. And like doctors, you can't discriminate against a person in need. We have to take on these elders and accept the broken glass and rusted nails. And the meat of an NA meeting is a series of auricular confessions minus the attendant absolution. And sometimes the people in these meetings are holding their hands up to some truly despicable acts. It's against the spirit of the thing to reveal specifics, but domestic abuse is a common one. And the following anecdote, it wasn't in an NA meeting or any other kind of therapeutic session. It took place during an informal conversation in a church hall about drug abuse and criminality. There was this one guy who had a big elastic grin and an awkward, ungainly hearing aid, the kind they probably stopped manufacturing when they discontinued the iron lung. Looked like someone had welded a fucking CD Walkman to the side of his head. After the rest of the group had finished unburdening themselves, confessing to recklessness or deviancy or anything in between, he told me he once found a mole when he was homeless and decided to keep it as a pet. if he was on the move, he'd carry it in his rucksack that he'd fashioned into a carrier case by sticking a chew box in there and the other bits. And when he was caught shoplifting an Audi, he opened his bag and shouted, "Release the mole," hoping it'd dive onto the security guard as if it was a Pokemon, but ended up flopping out of the rucksack and onto a baby in a pushchair. And when he finished telling the story, he said, "Yeah, I probably should have trained it first." I probably should have trained it. I think that was the problem. I should have trained it. Should have trained his mole. But anyway, that's this week's episode. Was it worth the wait? No. Next week, I'll tell you about the time I got an acorn stuck in my belly button. Anyway, I hope you have a lovely rest of the week and speak soon. Love you all. Bye.